happily corresponding with his new friend, Mr. Onitsuka, and with the entire production team at the Onitsuka factory. He was sending them bunches of ideas and modifications of their products. Though all people are the same under the skin, Bowerman had come to believe that all feet are not created equal. Americans have different bodies than Japanese do, longer, heavier, and Americans therefore need different shoes. After dissecting a dozen pairs of tigers, Bowerman saw how they could be tailored to cater to American customers. To that end, he had a slew of notes, sketches, designs, all of which he was firing off to Japan. Sadly, he was discovering, as I had, that no matter how well you got along in person with the team at Onitsuka, things were different once you were back on your side of the Pacific. Most of Bowerman's letters went unanswered. When there was an answer, it was cryptic or curtly dismissive. It pained me at times to think the Japanese were treating Bowerman the way I was treating Johnson. But Bowerman wasn't me. He didn't take rejection to heart. Like Johnson, when his letters went unanswered, Bowerman simply wrote more, with more underlined words, more exclamation marks. Nor did he flag in his experiments. He continued to tear apart tigers, continued to use the young men on his track teams as guinea pigs. During the autumn track season of 1965, every race had two results for Bowerman. There was the performance of his runners, and there was the performance of their shoes. Bowerman would note how the arches held up, how the soles gripped the cinders, how the toes pinched and the instep flexed. Then he'd airmail his notes and findings to Japan. Eventually, he broke through. Onitsuka made prototypes that conformed to Bowerman's vision of a more American shoe. Soft inner sole, more arch support, heel wedge to reduce stress on the Achilles tendon. They sent the prototype to Bowerman, and he went wild for it. He asked for more. He then handed these experimental shoes out to all his runners, who used them to crush the competition. A little success always went to Bowerman's head, in the best way. Around this time, he was also testing sports elixirs, magic potions and powders to give his runners more energy and stamina. When I was on his team, he talked about the importance of replacing an athlete's salt and electrolytes. He'd forced me and others to choke down a potion he'd invented, a vile goo of mushed bananas, lemonade, tea, honey, and several unnamed ingredients. Now, while tinkering with shoes, he was also monkeying with his sports drink recipe, making it taste worse and work better. It wasn't until years later that I realized Bowerman was trying to invent Gatorade. In his free time, he liked to noodle with the surface at Hayward Field. Hayward was hallowed ground, steeped in tradition, but Bowerman didn't believe in letting tradition slow you down. Whenever rain fell, which it did all the time in Eugene, Hayward's cinder lanes turned to Venetian canals. Bowerman thought something rubbery would be easier to dry, sweep, and clean. He also thought something rubbery might be more forgiving on his runner's feet. So he bought a cement mixer, filled it with old shredded tires and assorted chemicals, and spent hours searching for just the right consistency and texture. More than once, he made himself violently sick from inhaling the fumes of this witch's brew. Blinding headaches, a pronounced limp, loss of vision, these were a few of the lasting costs of his perfectionism. Again, it was years before I realized what Bowerman was actually up to. He was trying to invent polyurethane. I once asked him how he fit everything into a 24-hour day, coaching, traveling, experimenting, raising a family. He waved his hand as if to say, "It's nothing." Then he told me, sotto voce, that on top of everything else, he was also writing a book. "A book," I said. "About jogging," he said gruffly. Bowerman was forever griping that people make the mistake of thinking only elite Olympians are athletes. "But everyone's an athlete," he said. "If you have a body, you're an athlete." Now he was determined to get this point across to a larger audience, the reading public. "Sounds interesting," I said, but I thought my old coach had popped a screw. Who in heck would want to read a book about jogging? 1966. As I neared the end of my contract with Onitsuka, I checked the mail every day, hoping for a letter that would say they wanted to renew, or that they didn't. There would be relief in knowing either way. Of course, I was also hoping for a letter from Sarah, saying she changed her mind. And as always, I was braced for a letter from my bank, telling me my business was no longer welcome. But every day, the only letters were from Johnson. Like Bowerman, the man didn't sleep. Ever. I could think of no other explanation for his ceaseless stream of correspondence, much of which was pointless. Along with gobs of information I didn't need, the typical Johnson letter would include several long parenthetical asides, several pointless digressions, and some kind of rambling joke. There might also be a hand-drawn illustration. There might also be a musical lyric. Sometimes there was a poem. Batted out on a manual typewriter that violently brailled the onion skin pages, many Johnson letters contained some kind of story. Maybe parable is a better word. How Johnson had sold said person a pair of tigers, but down the road this person might be good for X more pairs, and therefore Johnson had a plan. How Johnson had chased and badgered the head coach at such and such high school, and tried to sell him 6 pairs, but in the end sold him a baker's dozen, which just went to show. Often, Johnson would describe in excruciating detail the latest ad he'd placed or was contemplating placing in the back pages of Long Distance Log or Track and Field News. Or he'd describe the photograph of a tiger shoe he'd included with the ad. He'd constructed a makeshift photo studio in his house, and he'd pose the shoes seductively on the sofa against a black sweater. Never mind that it sounded a bit like shoe porn, I just didn't see the point of placing ads in magazines read exclusively by running nerds. I didn't see the point of advertising, period. But Johnson seemed to be having fun, and he swore the ads worked, so fine, far be it from me to stop him. The typical Johnson letter would invariably close with a lament, either sarcastic or pointedly earnest, about my failure to respond to his previous letter, and the one before that, etc. Then there would be a P.S., and usually another P.S., and sometimes a pagoda of P.S.s. Then one last plea for encouraging words, which I never sent. I didn't have time for encouraging words. Besides, it wasn't my style. I look back now and wonder if I was truly being myself, or if I was emulating Bowerman, or my father, or both. Was I adopting their man of few words demeanor? Was I maybe modeling all the men I admired? At the time, I was reading everything I could get my hands on about generals, samurai, shoguns, along with biographies of my 3 main heroes, Churchill, Kennedy, and Tolstoy. I had no love of violence, but I was fascinated by leadership, or lack thereof, under extreme conditions. War is the most extreme of conditions. But business has its warlike parallels. Someone somewhere once said that business is war without bullets, and I tended to agree. I wasn't that unique. Throughout history, men have looked to the warrior for a model of Hemingway's cardinal virtue, pressurized grace. Hemingway himself wrote most of A Movable Feast while gazing at a statue of Marshal Ney, Napoleon's epic commander. One lesson I took from all my homeschooling about heroes was that they didn't say much. None was a blabbermouth. None micromanaged. Don't tell people how to do things. Tell them what to do and let them surprise you with their results. So I didn't answer Johnson, and I didn't pester him. Having told him what to do, I hoped that he would surprise me. Maybe with silence. To Johnson's credit, though he craved more communication, he never let the lack of it discourage him. On the contrary, it motivated him. He was anal. He recognized that I was not. And though he enjoyed complaining to me, my sister, to mutual friends, he saw that my managerial style gave him freedom. Left to do as he pleased, he responded with boundless creativity and energy. He worked 7 days a week, selling and promoting Blue Ribbon, and when he wasn't selling, he was beaverishly building up his customer data files. Each new customer got his or her own index card, and each index card contained that customer's personal information, shoe size, and shoe preferences. This database enabled Johnson to keep in touch with all his customers at all times, and to keep them all feeling special. He sent them Christmas cards. He sent them birthday cards. He sent them notes of congratulation after they completed a big race or marathon. Whenever I got a letter from Johnson, I knew it was one of dozens he'd carried down to the mailbox that day. He had hundreds and hundreds of customer correspondents, all along the spectrum of humanity, from high school track stars to octogenarian weekend joggers. Many, upon pulling yet another Johnson letter from their mailboxes, must have thought the same thing I did. Where does this guy find the time? Unlike me, however, most customers came to depend on Johnson's letters. Most wrote him back. They tell him about their lives, their troubles, their injuries, and Johnson would lavishly console, sympathize, and advise, especially about injuries. No one in the 1960s knew the first thing about running injuries or sports injuries in general. So Johnson's letters were often filled with information that was impossible to find anywhere else. I worried briefly about liability issues. I also worried that I'd one day get a letter saying Johnson had rented a bus and was driving them all to the doctor. Some customers freely volunteered their opinion about Tigers. So Johnson began aggregating this customer feedback, using it to create new design sketches. One man, for instance, complained that Tiger flats didn't have enough cushion. He wanted to run the Boston Marathon, but didn't think Tigers would last the 26 miles. So Johnson hired a local cobbler to graft rubber soles from a pair of shower shoes into a pair of Tiger flats. Voila. Johnson's Frankenstein flat had space-age full-length midsole cushioning. Today it's standard in all training shoes for runners. The jerry-rigged Johnson sole was so dynamic, so soft, so new, Johnson's customer posted a personal best in Boston. Johnson forwarded me the results and urged me to pass them along to Tiger. Bowerman had just asked me to do the same with his batch of notes a few weeks earlier. Good grief, I thought, one mad genius at a time. Every now and then, I'd make a mental note to warn Johnson about his growing list of pen pals. Blue Ribbon was supposed to confine itself to the 13 Western states, and full-time employee number one was not doing so. Johnson had customers in 37 states, including the entire Eastern Seaboard, which was the heart of Marlboro country. The Marlboro man wasn't doing anything with his territory, so Johnson's incursions seemed harmless. But we didn't want to rub the man's nose in it. Still, I never got around to telling Johnson my concerns. Per usual, I didn't tell him anything. At the start of summer, I decided my parents' basement was no longer big enough to serve as the headquarters of Blue Ribbon, and the servants' quarters weren't big enough for me. I rented a one-bedroom apartment downtown in a spiffy new high-rise. The rent was $200, which seemed pretty steep, but oh well. I also rented a few essentials, table, chairs, king-size bed, olive couch, and tried to arrange them stylishly. It didn't look like much, but I didn't care, because my real furniture was shoes. My first ever bachelor pad was filled from floor to ceiling with shoes. I toyed with the idea of not giving Johnson my new address, but I did. Sure enough, my new mailbox began to fill with letters. Return address, P.O. Box 492, Seal Beach, California, 90740. None of which I answered. Then Johnson wrote me two letters I couldn't ignore. First, he said that he, too, was moving. He and his new wife were splitting up. He was planning to stay in Seal Beach, but taking a small bachelor apartment. Days later, he wrote to say he'd been in a car wreck. It happened in the early morning, somewhere north of San Bernardino. He was on his way to a road race, of course, where he'd intended to both run and sell Tigers. He'd fallen asleep at the wheel, he wrote, and woke to find himself and his 1956 Volkswagen Bug upside down and airborne. He struck the divider, then rolled, then flew out of the car just before it somersaulted down the embankment. When Johnson's body finally stopped tumbling and rolling, he was on his back, looking at the sky, his collarbone, foot, and skull all shattered. The skull, he said, was actually leaking. Worse, being newly divorced, he had no one to care for him during his convalescence. The poor guy was one dead dog from becoming a country western song. Despite all these recent calamities, Johnson was of good cheer. He assured me in a series of chirpy follow-up letters that he was managing to meet all his obligations. He was dragging himself around his new apartment, filling orders, shipping shoes, corresponding promptly with all customers. A friend was bringing him his mail, he said, so not to worry. P.O. Box 492 was still fully operational. In closing, he added that because he was now facing alimony, child support, and untold medical bills, he needed to inquire about the long-term prospects of Blue Ribbon. How did I see the future? I didn't lie exactly. Maybe out of pity, maybe haunted by the image of Johnson, single, lonely, his body wrapped in plaster of Paris, gamely trying to keep himself and my company alive, I sounded an upbeat tone. Blue Ribbon, I said, would probably morph over the years into a generalized sporting goods company. We'd probably have offices on the West Coast, and one day, maybe, in Japan. Far-fetched, I wrote, but it seems worth shooting for. This last line was wholly truthful. It was worth shooting for. If Blue Ribbon went bust, I'd have no money, and I'd be crushed. But I'd also have some valuable wisdom, which I could apply to the next business. Wisdom seemed an intangible asset, but an asset all the same, one that justified the risk. Starting my own business was the only thing that made life's other risks, marriage, Vegas, alligator wrestling, seem like sure things. But my hope was that when I failed, if I failed, I'd fail quickly, so I'd have enough time, enough years to implement all the hard-won lessons. I wasn't much for setting goals, but this goal kept flashing through my mind every day until it became my internal chant, fail fast. In closing, I told Johnson that if he could sell 3,250 pairs of Tigers by the end of June 1966, completely impossible by my calculations, I would authorize him to open that retail outlet he'd been harassing me about. I even put a P.S. at the bottom, which I knew he'd devour like a candy treat. I reminded him that he was selling so many shoes so fast, he might want to speak to an accountant. There are income tax issues to consider, I said. He fired back a sarcastic thanks for the tax advice. He wouldn't be filing taxes, he said, because gross income was $1,209 while expenses total $1,245. His leg broken, his heart broken, he told me that he was also flat broke. He signed off, "Please send encouraging words." I didn't. Somehow Johnson hit the magic number. By the end of June, he'd sold 3,250 pairs of Tigers. And he'd healed. Thus, he was holding me to my end of the bargain. Before Labor Day, he leased a small retail space at 3107 Pico Boulevard in Santa Monica and opened our first ever retail store. He then set about turning the store into a mecca, a holy of holies for runners. He bought the most comfortable chairs he could find and afford, yard sales, and he created a beautiful space for runners to hang out and talk. He built shelves and filled them with books that every runner should read, many of them first editions from his own library. He covered the walls with photos of tiger-shoed runners and laid in a supply of silkscreen T-shirts with tiger across the front, which he handed out to his best customers. He also stuck tigers to a black lacquered wall and illuminated them with a strip of can lights. Very cool. Very mod. In all the world, there had never been such a sanctuary for runners. A place that didn't just sell them shoes, but celebrated them and their shoes. Johnson, the aspiring cult leader of runners, finally had his church. Services were Monday through Saturday, 9 to 6. When he first wrote me about the store, I thought of the temples and shrines I'd seen in Asia, and I was anxious to see how Johnson's compared. But there just wasn't time. Between my hours at Pricewaterhouse, my drunken revels with Hayes, my nights and weekends handling the minutia connected with Blue Ribbon, and my 14 hours each month soldiering in the reserves, I was running on fumes. Then Johnson wrote me a fateful letter, and I had no choice. I jumped on a plane. Johnson's customer pen pals now numbered in the hundreds, and one of them, a high school kid on Long Island, had written to Johnson and inadvertently revealed some troubling news. The kid said his track coach had recently been talking about acquiring Tigers from a new source. From some wrestling coach in Valley Stream, or Massapequa, or Manhasset. The Marlboro Man was back. He'd even placed a national ad in an issue of Track and Field. While Johnson was busy poaching on the Marlboro Man's turf, the Marlboro Man was poaching our poaching. Johnson had done all this marvelous groundwork, had built up this enormous customer base, had spread the word about Tigers through his tenacity and crude marketing campaigns, and now the Marlboro Man was going to swoop in and capitalize? I hopped on the next plane to Los Angeles. I'm not sure why I did. I could have phoned. Maybe like Johnson's customers, I just needed a sense of community, even if it was a community of two. The first thing we did was go for a long, punishing run on the beach. Then we bought a pizza and brought it back to his apartment, which was your standard divorce guy pad, only more so. Tiny, dark, sparse. It reminded me of some of the no-frills hostels where I'd stayed on my trip around the world. Of course, there were a few distinctly Johnsonian touches, like shoes everywhere. I thought my apartment was filled with shoes, but Johnson basically lived inside a running shoe. Shoved into every nook and cranny, spread across every surface, were running shoes, and more running shoes, most in some state of deconstruction. The few nooks and crannies that didn't hold shoes were filled with books, and more books, piled on homemade bookshelves, rough planks laid on cinder blocks. And Johnson didn't read trash. His collection was mostly thick volumes of philosophy, religion, sociology, anthropology, and the classics of Western literature. I thought I loved to read. Johnson was next level. What struck me most was the eerie violet light that suffused the whole place. Its source was a 75-gallon saltwater fish tank. After clearing a place for me on the sofa, Johnson patted the tank and explained. Most newly divorced guys like to prowl singles bars, but Johnson spent his nights prowling under the Seal Beach Pier looking for rare fish. He captured them with something called a slurp gun, which he waved under my nose. It looked like a prototype for the first ever vacuum cleaner. I asked how it worked. Just stick this nozzle into shallow water, he said, and suck up the fish into a plastic tube, then into a small chamber. Then shoot it into your bucket and schlep it home. He'd managed to accumulate a wide variety of exotic creatures, seahorses, opal eye perch, which he showed me with pride. He pointed out the jewel of his collection, a baby octopus he'd named Stretch. Speaking of which, Johnson said, it's feeding time. He reached into a paper sack and pulled out a live crab. Come on, Stretch, he said, dangling the crab over the tank. The octopus didn't stir. Johnson lowered the crab, legs wriggling, onto the tank's sand-strewn floor. Still no reaction from Stretch. He dead? I asked. Watch, Johnson said. The crab danced left and right, panicking, seeking cover. There was none, however, and Stretch knew it. After a few minutes, something emerged tentatively from Stretch's undercarriage, an antenna or tentacle. It unfurled toward the crab and lightly tapped its carapace. Yoo-hoo! Stretch just injected poison in the crab, Johnson said, grinning like a proud dad. We watched the crab slowly stop dancing, stop moving altogether. We watched Stretch gently wrap his antenna tentacle around the crab and drag it back to his lair, a hole he dug into the sand beneath a big rock. It was a morbid puppet show, A dark kabuki play starring a witless victim and a micro-kraken. Was it a sign, a metaphor for our dilemma? One living thing being eaten by another? This was life, red in tooth and claw. And I couldn't help wondering if it was also the story of Blue Ribbon and the Marlboro Man. We spent the rest of the evening sitting at Johnson's kitchen table and going over the letter from his Long Island informant. He read it aloud, and then I read it silently, and then we debated what to do. "Get thee to Japan," Johnson said. "What?" "You gotta go," he said. "Tell them about the work we've done. Demand your rights. Kill this Marlboro Man once and for all. Once he starts selling running shoes, once he really gets going, there will be no stopping him. Either we draw a line in the sand right now, or it's over." "I'd just come back from Japan," I said, "and I didn't have the money to go again. I'd poured all my savings into Blue Ribbon, and I couldn't possibly ask Wallace for another loan." The thought nauseated me. Also, I didn't have time. Price Waterhouse allowed 2 weeks vacation a year, unless you needed that 2 weeks for the reserves, which I did. Then they gave you one extra week, which I'd already used. Above all, I told Johnson, it's no use. The Marlboro Man's relationship with Onitsuka predates mine. Undaunted, Johnson pulled out his typewriter, the one he'd been using to torture me, and began drafting notes, ideas, lists, which we could then turn into a manifesto for me to deliver to the executives at Onitsuka. While Stretch finished off the crab, we munched our pizza and guzzled beer and plotted late into the night. Back in Oregon the next afternoon, I went straight in to see the office manager at Price Waterhouse. "I've got to have 2 weeks off," I said, "right now." He looked up from the papers on his desk and glared at me, and for one hellishly long moment, I thought I was going to be fired. Instead, he cleared his throat and mumbled something. Odd. I couldn't make out every word, but he seemed to think, from my intensity, my vagueness, I'd gotten someone pregnant. I took a step back and started to protest, then shut my mouth. Let the man think what he wants, so long as he gives me the time. Running a hand through his thinning hair, he finally sighed and said, "Go. Good luck. Hope it all works out." I put the airfare on my credit card. 12 months to pay. And unlike my last visit to Japan, this time I wired ahead. I told the executives at Onitsuka that I was coming and that I wanted a meeting. They wired back, "Come ahead." But their wire went on to say that I wouldn't be meeting with Morimoto. He was either fired or dead. There was a new export manager, the wire said. His name was Kitami. Again, I found myself boarding a flight for Japan. Again, I found myself underlining and memorizing my copy of How to Do Business with the Japanese. Again, I found myself taking the train to Kobe, checking into the new port, pacing my room while engaged in a heated discussion with myself. At 0 hour, I took a cab over to Onitsuka. I expected that we'd go into the old conference room, but no, they'd done some remodeling since my last visit. New conference room, they said. Sleeker, bigger. It had leather chairs instead of the old cloth ones, and a much longer table. More impressive, but less familiar. I felt disoriented, intimidated. It was like prepping for a meet at Oregon State and learning at the last minute that it had been moved to the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum. A man walked into the conference room and extended his hand. Kitami. His black shoes were brightly polished, his hair equally polished, jet black, swept straight back, not a strand out of place. He was a great contrast to Morimoto, who always looked as if he'd dressed blindfolded. I was put off by Kitami's veneer, but suddenly he gave me a warm, ready smile and encouraged me to sit, relax, tell him why I'd come. And now I got the distinct sense that, despite his slick appearance, he wasn't altogether sure of himself. He was in a brand new job, after all. He didn't yet have much equity. The word sprang to mind. It occurred to me also that I had high value for Kitami. I wasn't a big client, but I wasn't small either. Location is everything. I was selling shoes in America, a market vital to the future of Onitsuka. Maybe, just maybe, Kitami didn't want to lose me just yet. Maybe he wanted to hold on to me until they transitioned to the Marlboro Man. I was an asset. I was a credit for the moment, which meant I might be holding better cards than I thought. Kitami spoke more English than his predecessors, but with a thicker accent. My ear needed a few minutes to adjust as we chatted about my flight, the weather, sales. All the while, other executives were filing in, joining us at the conference table. At last, Kitami leaned back. "Hi." He waited. "Mr. Onitsuka?" I said. "Mr. Onitsuka will not be able to join us today," he said. Damn. I was hoping to draw upon Mr. Onitsuka's fondness for me, not to mention his bond with Bowerman. But no. Alone, without allies, trapped in the unfamiliar conference room, I plunged ahead. I told Kitami and the other executives that Blue Ribbon had done a remarkable job thus far. We'd sold out every order while developing a robust customer base, and we expected this solid growth to continue. We had $44,000 in sales for 1966, and projected to have $84,000 in 1967. I described our new store in Santa Monica and laid out plans for other stores for a big future. Then I leaned in. "We would very much like to be the exclusive U.S. distributor for Tiger's track and field line," I said. "And I think it is very much in Tiger's interest that we become that." I didn't even mention the Marlboro Man. I looked around the table. Grim faces. None grimmer than Kitami's. He said in a few terse words that this would not be possible. Onitsuka wanted for its U.S. distributor someone bigger, more established, a firm that could handle the workload. A firm with offices on the East Coast. But, I spluttered, "Blue Ribbon does have offices on the East Coast." Kitami rocked back in his chair. "Oh?" "Yes," I said, "we're on the East Coast, the West Coast, and soon we may be in the Midwest. We can handle national distribution, no question." I looked around the table. The grim faces were becoming less grim. "Well," Kitami said, "this changed things." He assured me that they would give my proposal careful consideration. So, hi, meeting adjourned. I walked back to my hotel and spent a second night pacing. First thing the next morning, I received a call summoning me back to Onitsuka, where Kitami awarded me exclusive distribution rights for the United States. He gave me a 3-year contract. I tried to be nonchalant as I signed the papers and placed an order for 5,000 more shoes, which would cost $20,000 I didn't have. Kitami said he'd ship them to our East Coast office, which I also didn't have. I promised to wire him the exact address. On the flight home, I looked out the window at the clouds above the Pacific Ocean, and I thought back to sitting atop Mount Fuji. I wondered how Sarah would feel about me now, after this coup. I wondered how the Marlboro Man would feel when he got word from Onitsuka that he was toast. I stowed away my copy of How to Do Business with the Japanese. My carry-on was stuffed with souvenirs, kimonos for my mother and sisters and Mom Hatfield, a tiny samurai sword to hang above my desk, and my crowning glory, a small Japanese TV. Spoils of war, I thought, smiling. But somewhere over the Pacific, the full weight of my victory came over me. I imagined the look on Wallace's face when I asked him to cover this gigantic new order. If he said no, when he said no, what then? On the other hand, if he said yes, how was I going to open an office on the East Coast? And how was I going to do it before those shoes arrived? And who was I going to get to run it? I stared at the curved, glowing horizon. There was only one person on the planet rootless enough, energetic enough, gung-ho enough, crazy enough to pick up and move to the East Coast on a moment's notice and get there before the shoes did. I wondered how Stretch was going to like the Atlantic Ocean. 1967. I didn't handle it well. Not well at all. Knowing what his reaction would be and dreading it, I put off telling Johnson the whole story. I shot him a quick note saying the meeting with Onitsuka had gone well, telling him I'd secured national distribution rights. But I left it at that. I think I must have held out hope in the back of my mind that I might be able to hire someone else to go east, or that Wallace would blow the whole plan up. And in fact, I did hire someone else, a former distance runner, of course. But he changed his mind, backed out, just days after agreeing to go. So, frustrated, distracted, mired in a cycle of anxiety and procrastination, I turned to the much simpler problem of finding someone to replace Johnson at the store in Santa Monica. I asked John Bork, a high school track coach in Los Angeles, a friend of a friend. He jumped at the chance. He couldn't have been more eager. How could I have known he'd be quite so eager? The next morning he appeared at Johnson's store and announced that he was the new boss. The new what? Johnson said. I've been hired to take over for you when you go back east, Bork said. When I go where? Johnson said, reaching for the phone. I didn't handle that conversation well either. I told Johnson that, ha ha, hey man, I was just about to call you. I said I was sorry he'd heard the news that way, how awkward, and I explained that I'd been forced to lie to Onitsuka and claim we already had an office on the East Coast. Thus, we were in one heck of a jam. The shoes would soon be on the water, an enormous shipment steaming for New York, and no one but Johnson could handle the task of claiming those shoes and setting up an office. The fate of Blue Ribbon rested on his shoulders. Johnson was flabbergasted, then furious, then freaked, all in the space of 1 minute. So I got on a plane and flew down to visit him at his store. He didn't want to live on the East Coast, he told me. He loved California. He'd lived in California all his life. He could go running year-round in California, and running, as I knew, was all to Johnson. How was he supposed to go running during those bitter cold winters back east? On and on it went. All at once, his manner changed. We were standing in the middle of his store, his sneaker sanctuary, and in a barely audible mumble, he acknowledged that this was a make-or-break moment for Blue Ribbon, in which he was heavily invested, financially, emotionally, spiritually. He acknowledged that there was no one else who could set up an East Coast office. He delivered himself of a long, rambling, semi-internal monologue, saying that the Santa Monica store practically ran itself, so he could train his replacement in one day. And he'd already set up a store in a remote location once, so he could do it again, fast, and we needed it done fast, with the shoes on the water and back-to-school orders about to roll in. And then he looked off and asked the walls, or the shoes, or the Great Spirit, why he shouldn't just obey me blindly and be down on his knees grateful for the damn opportunity, when anyone could see that he was, he searched for the exact words, a talentless fuck. I might have said something like, oh, no, you're not. Don't be so hard on yourself. I might have, but I didn't. I kept my mouth shut and waited. And waited. Okay, he said at last. I'll go. Great. That's great. Terrific. Thank you. But where? Where what? Do you want me to go? Ah, yes, well, anywhere on the East Coast with a port? Just don't go to Portland, Maine. Why? A company based in two different Portlands, that'll confuse the heck out of the Japanese. We hashed it out some more and finally decided New York and Boston were the most logical places. Especially Boston. It's where most of our orders are coming from, one of us said. Okay, he said, Boston, here I come. Then I handed him a bunch of travel brochures for Boston, playing up the fall foliage angle. A little heavy-handed, but I was desperate. He asked how I happened to have these brochures on me, and I told him I knew he'd make the right decision. He laughed. The forgiveness Johnson showed me, the overall good nature he demonstrated, filled me with gratitude. and a new fondness for the man. And perhaps a deeper loyalty. I regretted my treatment of him. All those unanswered letters. There are team players, I thought, and then there are team players. And then there's Johnson. And then he threatened to quit. Via letter, of course. I think I have been responsible for what success we have had so far, he wrote, and any success that will be coming in for the next 2 years at least. Therefore, he gave me a two-part ultimatum. One, make him a full partner in Blue Ribbon. Two, raise his salary to $600 a month, plus a third of all profits beyond the first 6,000 pairs of shoes sold. Or else, he said, goodbye. I phoned Bowerman and told him that full-time employee number one was staging a mutiny. Bowerman listened quietly, considered all the angles, weighed the pros and cons, then rendered his verdict. Fuck him. I said I wasn't sure fucking him was the best strategy. Maybe there was some middle way of mollifying Johnson, of giving him a stake in the company. But as we talked about it in greater detail, the math just didn't pencil out. Neither Bowerman nor I wanted to surrender any portion of our stake, so Johnson's ultimatum, even if I'd wanted to accept it, wasn't possible. I flew to Palo Alto, where Johnson was visiting his parents, and asked for a sit-down. Johnson said he wanted his father, Owen, to join us. The meeting took place at Owen's office, and I was immediately stunned by the similarities between father and son. They looked alike, sounded alike, even had many of the same mannerisms. The similarities ended there, however. From the start, Owen was loud, aggressive, and I could see that he'd been the instigator behind this mutiny. By trade, Owen was a salesman. He sold voice recording equipment, like dictaphones, and he was darn good at it. For him, as with most salesmen, life was one long negotiation, which he relished. In other words, he was my complete opposite. Here we go, I thought, yet another shootout with a consummate negotiator. When will it end? Before getting down to brass tacks, Owen first wanted to tell me a story. Salesmen always do. Since I was an accountant, he said, he was reminded of an accountant he'd met recently who had a topless dancer for a client. The story, I believe, revolved around whether the dancer's silicone implants were deductible. At the punchline, I laughed, to be polite, then gripped the arms of my chair and waited for Owen to stop laughing and make his opening move. He began by citing all the things his son had done for Blue Ribbon. He insisted that his son was the main reason Blue Ribbon still existed. I nodded, let him talk himself out, and resisted the urge to make eye contact with Johnson, who sat off to the side. I wondered if they'd rehearsed all this, the way Johnson and I rehearsed my pitch before my trip to Japan. When Owen finished, when he said that given the facts, his son obviously should be a full partner in Blue Ribbon, I cleared my throat and conceded that Johnson was a dynamo, that his work had been vital and invaluable. But then I dropped the hammer. The truth of the matter is, we have $40,000 in sales, and more than that in debt, so there's simply nothing to divvy up here, fellas. We're fighting over slices of a pie that doesn't exist. Moreover, I told Owen that Bowerman was unwilling to sell any of his half of Blue Ribbon, and therefore I couldn't sell. If I did sell any of my half, I'd be surrendering majority control of the thing I'd created. That just wasn't feasible. I made my counteroffer. I would give Johnson a $50 raise. Owen stared. It was a fierce, tough stare honed during many intense negotiations. A lot of dictaphones had moved out the door after that stare. He was waiting for me to bend, to up my offer. But for once in my life, I had leverage, because I had nothing left to give. Take it or leave it is like four of a kind. Hard to beat. Finally, Owen turned to his son. I think we both knew from the start that Johnson would be the one to settle this, and I saw in Johnson's face that two contrary desires were fighting for his heart. He didn't want to accept my offer, but he didn't want to quit. He loved Blue Ribbon. He needed Blue Ribbon. He saw Blue Ribbon as the one place in the world where he fit, an alternative to the corporate abyss that had swallowed most of our schoolmates and friends, most of our generation. He'd complained a million times about my lack of communication. But in fact, my laissez-faire management style had fostered him, unleashed him. He wasn't likely to find that freedom anywhere else. After several seconds, he reached out his hand. "Deal," he said. "Deal," I said, shaking it. We sealed our new agreement with a 6-mile run. As I remember, I won. With Johnson on the East Coast and Bork taking over his store, I was awash in employees. And then I got a call from Bowerman asking me to add yet another, one of his former track guys, Jeff Hollister. I took Hollister out for a hamburger, and we got along fine, but he cinched the deal by not even flinching when I reached into my pocket and found I didn't have any money to pay for lunch. So I hired him to go around the state selling Tigers, thereby making him full-time employee number 3. Soon Bowerman phoned again. He wanted me to take on another person. Quadrupling my staff in the span of a few months? Did my old coach think I was General Motors? I might have balked, but then Bowerman said the job candidate's name. Bob Woodell. I knew the name, of course. Everyone in Oregon knew the name. Woodell had been a standout on Bowerman's 1965 team. Not quite a star, but a gritty and inspiring competitor. With Oregon defending its second national championship in 3 years, Woodell had come out of nowhere and won the long jump against vaunted UCLA. I'd been there, I'd watched him do it, and I'd come away mighty impressed. The next day, there had been a bulletin on TV, an accident at Oregon's Mother's Day celebrations. Woodell and 20 of his frat brothers were hoisting a float down to the mill race, a stream that wound through campus. They were trying to flip it over, and someone lost their footing. Then someone lost their hold. Someone else let go. Someone screamed, everyone ran. The float collapsed, trapping Woodell underneath, crushing his first lumbar vertebra. There seemed little hope of his walking again. Bowerman had held a twilight meet at Hayward Field to raise money for Woodell's medical expenses. Now he faced the task of finding something for Woodell to do. At present, he said, the poor guy was sitting around his parents' house in a wheelchair, staring at the walls. Woodell had made tentative inquiries about being Bowerman's assistant coach, but Bowerman said to me, "I just don't think that's going to work, Buck. Maybe he could do something for Blue Ribbon." I hung up and dialed Woodell. I nearly said how sorry I was about his accident, but I caught myself. I wasn't sure that was the right thing to say. In my mind, I ran through another half dozen things, each of which seemed wrong. I'd never been so at a loss for words, and I'd spent half my life tongue-tied. What does one say to a track star who suddenly can't move his legs? I decided to keep it strictly business. I explained that Bowerman had recommended Woodell and said I might have a job for him with my new shoe company. I suggested we get together for lunch. "Sure thing," he said. We met the next day at a sandwich shop in downtown Beaverton, a suburb north of Portland. Woodell drove there himself. He'd already mastered a special car, a Mercury Cougar with hand controls. In fact, he was early. I was 15 minutes late. If not for his wheelchair, I don't know that I'd have recognized Woodell when I first walked in. I'd seen him once in person and several times on TV, but after his many ordeals and surgeries, he was shockingly thinner. He'd lost 60 pounds, and his naturally sharp features were now drawn with a much finer pencil. His hair, however, was still jet black, and still grew in remarkably tight curls. He looked like a bust or frieze of Hermes I'd seen somewhere in the Greek countryside. His eyes were black, and they shone with a steeliness, a shrewdness, maybe a sadness. Not unlike Johnson's. Whatever it was mesmerizing and endearing. I regretted being late. Lunch was supposed to be a job interview, but the interview part was a formality we both knew. Men of Oregon take care of their own. Fortunately, blind loyalty aside, we hit it off. we made each other laugh, mostly about Bowerman. We reminisced about the many ways he tortured runners, ostensibly to instill toughness, like heating a key on a stove and pressing it against their naked flesh in the sauna. We'd both fallen victim. Before long, I felt that I'd have given Woodell a job even if he'd been a stranger. Gladly. He was my kind of people. I wasn't certain what Blue Ribbon was, or if it would ever become a thing at all. But whatever it was, or might become, I hoped it would have something of this man's spirit. I offered him a position opening our second retail store, in Eugene, off the campus, at a monthly salary of $400. He didn't negotiate, thank goodness. If he'd asked for $4,000 a month, I might have found a way. "Deal?" I said. "Deal," he said. He reached out, shook my hand. He still had the strong grip of an athlete. The waitress brought the check, and I told Woodell grandly that lunch was on me. I pulled out my wallet and found that it was empty. I asked Blue Ribbon's full-time employee number 4 if he could float me. Just till payday. When he wasn't sending me new employees, Bowerman was sending me the results of his latest experiments. In 1966, he'd noticed that the spring up's outer sole melted like butter, whereas the midsole remained solid. So he'd urged Onitsuka to take spring up's midsole and fuse it with the limber up's outer sole, thus creating the ultimate distance training shoe. Now, in 1967, Onitsuka sent us the prototype, and it was astonishing. With its luxurious cushioning and its sleek lines, it looked like the future. Onitsuka asked what we thought it should be called. Bowerman liked Aztec, in homage to the 1968 Olympics, which were being held in Mexico City. "I like that, too." "Fine," Onitsuka said. "The Aztec was born." And then Adidas threatened to sue. Adidas already had a new shoe named the Azteca Gold, a track spike they were planning to introduce at the upcoming Olympics. No one had ever heard of it, but that didn't stop Adidas from kicking up a fuss. Aggravated, I drove up the mountain to Bowerman's house to talk it all over. We sat on the wide porch looking down at the river. It sparkled that day like a silver shoelace. He took off his ball cap, put it on again, rubbed his face. "Who was that guy who kicked the shit out of the Aztecs?" he asked. "Cortez," I said. He grunted. "Okay, let's call it the Cortez." I was developing an unhealthy contempt for Adidas. Or maybe it was healthy. That one German company had dominated the shoe market for a couple of decades, and they possessed all the arrogance of unchallenged dominance. Of course, it's possible they weren't arrogant at all, that to motivate myself I needed to see them as a monster. In any event, I despised them. I was tired of looking up every day and seeing them far, far ahead. I couldn't bear the thought that it was my fate to do so forever. The situation put me in mind of Jim Grella. In high school, Grella, or sometimes Gorilla, had been the fastest runner in Oregon, and I had been the second fastest, which meant 4 years of staring at Grella's back. Then Grella and I both went to the University of Oregon, where his tyranny over me continued. By the time I graduated, I hoped never again to see Grella's back. Years later, when Grella won the 1500 in Moscow's Lenin Stadium, I was wearing an army uniform, sitting on a couch in the day room at Fort Lewis. I pumped my fist at the screen, proud of my fellow Oregonian, but I also died a little at the memory of the many times he'd bested me. Now I began to see Adidas as a second Grella. Chasing them, being legally checked by them, irritated me to no end. It also drove me hard. Once again, in my quixotic effort to overtake a superior opponent, I had Bowerman as my coach. Once again, he was doing everything he could to put me in position to win. I often drew on the memory of his old pre-race pep talks, especially when we were up against our blood rivals, Oregon State. I would replay Bowerman's epic speeches, hear him telling us that Oregon State wasn't just any opponent. Beating USC and Cal was important, he said, but beating Oregon State was different. Nearly 60 years later, it gives me chills to recall his words, his tone. No one could get your blood going like Bowerman, though he never raised his voice. He knew how to speak in subliminal italics, to slyly insert exclamation marks like hot keys against the flesh. For extra inspiration, I'd sometimes think back to the first time I saw Bowerman walking around the locker room and handing out new shoes. When he came to me, I wasn't even sure I'd made the team. I was a freshman, still unproven, still developing. But he shoved a new pair of spikes straight into my chest. Knight, he said. That was all he said. Just my name, not a syllable more. I looked down at the shoes. They were Oregon green with yellow stripes, the most breathtaking things I'd ever seen. I cradled them, and later I carried them back to my room and put them gingerly on the top shelf of my bookcase. I remember that I trained my gooseneck desk lamp on them. They were Adidas, of course. By the tail end of 1967, Bowerman was inspiring many people besides me. That book he'd been talking about, that silly book about jogging, was done and out in bookstores. A slight 100 pages, Jogging preached the gospel of physical exercise to a nation that had never heard that sermon before. A nation that was collectively lolling on the couch, and somehow the book caught fire. It sold 1 million copies, sparked a movement, changed the very meaning of the word running. Before long, thanks to Bowerman and his book, running was no longer just for weirdos. It was no longer a cult. It was almost cool. I was happy for him, but also for Blue Ribbon. His bestseller would surely generate publicity and bump our sales. Then I sat down and read the thing. My stomach dropped. In his discussion of proper equipment, Bowerman gave some common sense advice, followed by some confounding recommendations. Discussing shin splints, or buckshins, he said the right shoes were important, but almost any shoes would work. Probably the shoes you wear for gardening or working around the house will do just fine. What? As for workout clothes, Bowerman told readers that proper clothing may help the spirit, but added that people shouldn't get hung up on brands. Maybe he thought this was true for the casual jogger as opposed to the trained athlete, but by God, did he need to say so in print? When we were fighting to establish a brand? More to the point, what did this mean about his true opinion of Blue Ribbon and me? Any shoe would do? If that were true, why in the world were we bothering to sell Tigers? Why were we jackassing around? Here I was, chasing Adidas, but in a strange way, I was still chasing Bowerman, seeking his approval. And as always, it seemed highly unlikely in late 1967 that I'd ever catch either one. Thanks largely to Bowerman's Cortez, we closed the year in a blaze, meeting our expectation of revenue, $84,000. I almost looked forward to my next trip to First National. Finally, Wallace would back off, loosen the purse strings. Maybe he'd even concede the value of growth. In the meantime, Blue Ribbon had outgrown my apartment. Maybe it's more accurate to say that it had taken over. The place was now the equal of Johnson's bachelor pad. All it needed was a violet light and a baby octopus. I couldn't put it off any longer. I needed a proper office space. So I rented a large room on the east side of town. It wasn't much. A plain old workspace with a high ceiling and high windows, several of which were broken or stuck open, meaning the room was a constant brisk 50 degrees. Right next door was a raucous tavern, the Pink Bucket. And every day at 4 p.m., promptly, the jukebox would kick in. The walls were so thin, you could hear the first record drop and feel every thumping note thereafter. You could almost hear people striking matches, lighting cigarettes, clinking glasses. Cheers, salute, mud in your eye. But the rent was cheap, $50 a month. When I took Woodell to see it, he allowed it had a certain charm. Woodell needed to like it because I was transferring him from the Eugene store to this office. He'd shown tremendous skills at the store, a flair for organizing, along with boundless energy, but I could use him better in what